here we go. Okay, thank you everyone for joining our inaugural class on Ramban's Shar HaGmul. Now, what is Shar HaGmul? My goal in this class series that we're going to do together is to explore the major philosophical, theological questions that honestly don't even just plague Jewish thought, but plague any basic religious system of thought. We're going to deal primarily with the question of theodicy, which Ramban is going to address why bad things happen to good people, why good things happen to bad people. And Ramban is, being a medieval rabbinic philosopher, he's going to attempt to solve these questions and explain the system of divine justice. And there's going to be numerous other questions that come up, like what happens after we die? What is Gehenna and hell? How does Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, what is that like? There's going to be all sorts of questions that we hope to address. I will say, unlike my halachic class that I'll be giving on Monday evenings, you know, it's coming week will be Tuesday, Jewish philosophy has a bit of a different tenor to it, in the sense that halacha is a much more rigorous and sometimes almost mathematical system where we could get to what we think is a conclusive answer many times. But when it comes to Jewish philosophy, as you will see, we will try to base things on proofs. We will try to base different conjectures and assumptions on verses from the Torah and from the Talmud. But ultimately, when I am explaining how we answer certain philosophical questions, I want to be clear that I'm being descriptive as opposed to prescriptive. I'm here to describe how different rabbinic philosophers addressed and struggled with these major questions. I by no means think that I am going to provide for you a conclusion to questions that have plagued the entire world for centuries since nearly the beginning of time. Okay, so I just want to make that clear. I'm not better than the Rambam, I'm not better than Aristotle when it comes to answering these. The second thing is that we're going to use a sefer called Shar HaGmul by the Ramban, which is really part of a larger book called Toras HaAdam, which is his work on Avelus, on mourning, on death and dying in Jewish law. But Ramban figured, if I'm talking about the laws of death and dying, and I'm talking about the laws of what happens to someone at that point at the end of their life, maybe I should spend the last part of the book talking about what happens after death, what happens in the afterlife. And that is what the last shar, the last, let's say, section or chapter of the book deals with. And that's what we're going to be looking at. Now, the text we're going to look at is, I could only find it in Hebrew. So I just want to give a word of preface, especially for those who were with us last night. The Hebrew text, anytime I bring a text in, think of it as a supplement. It's there to provide a textual basis for what I'm telling you. If you don't like looking at a text, you're welcome to not accept my share screen option, and you're welcome to just look at me and look at the other people in the group as I talk. I hope my goal is that anyone joining our class can understand what I'm saying, even if they feel that they're not comfortable accessing the text that I bring in. Otherwise, it would just be a crazy amount of typing up every single thing we're going to read, which, God give me more time, I can do it. Okay, so now I'm going to share the screen, and I want to introduce the book with a particular Gemara, one that some of us may already be familiar with. Okay. So there's a Gemara. I hope that this class, at very least, should bring us through high holidays, but I hope to get feedback from all of you, and you'll tell me if it's something you'd like to continue past that. The Gemara starts off talking about what happens on Rosh Hashanah. So Rosh Hashanah is the Jewish day of judgment. Yom Kippur is a day of atonement. Rosh Hashanah is the day of judgments, the Yom HaDin. So how does the judgment work on Rosh Hashanah? Amar Rav Krismadai. So here's the Aramaic. And on the bottom over here is Hebrew. I'm going to translate the Aramaic. You're welcome to look in the English as well if you like. Amar Rav Krismadai, Amar Rav Yochanan. Shlosha Sfarim Niftachin Barosh Hashanah. There are three books that are open before God on Rosh Hashanah. Echad Shel Rishayim Gemurim. One book that is open is of those who are fully, absolutely, unequivocally wicked. The Echad Shel Tzadikim Gemurim. And one is for the antithesis of them, which are the fully devout and righteous ones. The Echad Shel Beinonim. And then there's a third book, which is for those who are in between, who aren't fully righteous and aren't fully wicked. Tzadikim Gemur Nichtavin V'Nichtamin La'Alter L'Chaim. So the righteous people in Rosh Hashanah, they are immediately written down. They are immediately sealed in the book of life. Rishayim Gemurin, and those who are fully wicked, Nichtavin Nichtamin La'Alter L'Misa, they immediately get sentenced to death for the coming year. And Beinanim, those who are in between, we'll talk about exactly what that definition is in a later class. Tuluyim va'omdim mei Rosh Hashanah v'an Yom Kippurim. They are suspended from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippurim to be given a chance in order to atone for any sins. Let's assume for now that someone who's in between, it means literally a Beinoni, he's 50%, imagine you have the scale, 50% good deeds and 50% bad deeds, 50% mitzvos, 50% averos. And the idea of the Aseres Mei Tshuva, those days in between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, is to give him a chance to atone for those sins so he can be thrown in the same book as the righteous. So, Zachu Nichtavin L'Chaim, if he atones for his sins over the course of those days of Tshuva, then he gets written down for life for the coming year. But Lo Zachu, if he does not atone for his sins, Nichtavin L'Misa, he is sentenced to death along with the Rishayim. Now, if I were to ask you now, does this, just descriptively, if you look out into the world after each Rosh Hashanah, does this din make sense? Does this description of what happens make sense? What would you find problematic with the description of the Gemara of how the righteous are put in the book of life and the wicked are put in the book of death? What's the obvious question here?
The wicked are not automatically put to death. We have them still going on and on.
Exactly. So this is the question here, which is, wait a minute. If you look out into the world, we know, unfortunately, many wicked people who are prosperous, and we know many seemingly righteous people who suffer in this world. So now I'm going to show you, now we're going to go into Shaar HaGmul. This Gemara is what the Ramban is addressing right at the beginning of his book. So let's bring up now the Shaar HaGmul. And again, I will try to explain everything. Think of this book as a supplement. You're welcome to close your eyes also and not look at the text if you don't want to. Okay. So right at the beginning, he quotes the Gemara. This entire paragraph right here is what we just saw in the Gemara. And the Ramban now asks Susan's question, which is, Zesha amru chachamim lit tzadikim gemurim. By the way, are the letters big enough, or should I zoom in more?
They're good.
Okay. Zesha amru chachamim tzadikim gemurim shenechtavim lechayim urishayim gemurim shenechtavim lemisa. That which the rabbis just told us, that the righteous, those who are completely righteous, get put in the book of life, and those who are completely wicked get put in the book of death. Lo tzadikim she'ein lehem avonos, lo urishayim she'ein lehem zchuyos. Are there not righteous people who also have sinned? And are there not also wicked people that have some form of merit? They must have performed some kind of mitzvah in their entire lives. Shekama tzadikim mason la'alter. If we look into the world, hachush machish, our senses tell us otherwise. There are many righteous people that die immediately. Ukama rishayim arichin yomim b'sham. There are many wicked people that live out long lives and they get to live in peace and tranquility. So what the Gemara is telling us doesn't fit with our lives and our experience, which is the basic question of theodicy. You can see all the footnotes that we're skipping right now, just to familiarize ourselves for those who want to follow in the text. The top section over here is actually the Ramban's writing in Shaar HaGmul. I don't know why I'm pointing my finger. The top part over here is what the Ramban says. We're going to go through a section of the Ramban. And then there's also the footnotes over here. This is written by a contemporary scholar. It's called the Chazon Yoel. Here, what he does for us is he brings in other rabbinic philosophers who disagree with the Ramban. And what this serves for us is not just understanding the Ramban's philosophy, but what we're going to do is we're going to use this to use the Shaar HaGmul as a springboard for exploring a whole range of different approaches of Jewish philosophers. So don't think that we're just limited to one approach. We're going to get there soon. So back to our question. Even the verse itself in Kohelis in Ecclesiastes tells us, don't we know, we lament that there are righteous people, that they get treated by God as if they are wicked. And they're also Rishayim that get treated like the righteous. It's in the Torah, in the Tanakh itself. Ukvar Amar Rabbi Seinu, and our rabbis told us in Pirkei Avos, Ein biyadeinu shavas harashayim af lo yisuri tzadikim. We cannot comprehend why is it that there are so many wicked people that get to prosper, get have tranquil, pure, complete lives. And meanwhile, there are many righteous people who have the opposite of that. Zu Torah v'zu schara, is this the Torah, is this the reward for it? That is his formulation of the question. And I think we have the question down clearly, unless anyone wants me to sharpen it at all. Okay. So that's the question. Here's how the Ramban's going to answer it. And notice how he really tries to be methodical in how he goes about answering the question. He says, Elakachi Hamida. This is our answer. Yesh avonos shadino shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, u'mishpatav ha-tzadikim lifarei lehem ba'olam hazeh. There are certain instances where God takes his justice in this world. There are those who they get their just deserts, they get their punishment or reward in the world to come. It works the same for mitzvahs as well. There are people who get the reward in this world, and there are certain kinds of people that their reward is saved for the afterlife. So now, who gets their reward in this world and who gets their reward in the afterlife? When someone sins the entire year long, it's a lot of footnotes, and he's constantly accumulating sins. So you can imagine, if we look at the scales, his scale is further going down, being weighed down by sins. However, there are people who also, they occasionally, they give a few dollars to tzedakah, they donate a little to charity, they'll come to davening on occasion, so they have some good, they have some good deeds as well. So what God has to do in God's accounting books, as it were, is figure out who should get the reward in this world, who should get the reward in the next world. Now, you may be asking, okay, how does God figure that out? How does God determine who gets rewarded in this world and who gets rewarded in the world to come? So what he's going to do now is he's going to answer that the Gemara that we read at the beginning of this class, the Gemara that we read cannot be read precisely literally. You see, the Gemara that we read says that tzaddikim gemurin, absolute righteous people, get ridden for life, and then absolutely wicked people get ridden down for death. It doesn't mean literally righteous people, and it doesn't mean literally wicked people. And he's going to explain himself right here. So yesh mini adam shehem bechlal tzaddikim gemurin nechtam v'nechtam l'alter l'chaim. There are people who aren't even righteous, but they also can be considered, they fall into the category of a tzaddik. But tzaddik shu tzaddik gamor, zocheh l'chaim, it says that the righteous person inherits life. Now, which it says the righteous go to life, the wicked go to death. What's that mean? Klomar. Nimsa zetzadik gamor bidino. meaning this person falls under a category called a tzaddik gamor. See, there's two kinds of people there in this category. There are actually tzaddikim gemurim. In theory, the thing is, this rarely, if ever, existed. Even we're going to get to in a moment, Moshe Rabbeinu, one of the most righteous people ever to have lived, he committed a sin as well, right? We're in that area of the Torah now, with Moshe hitting the rock. So there are people, every righteous person, almost every righteous person, has some form of sin. But in theory, if there was such a person that never committed a sin in their entire life, you know what? They'd have nothing to be punished for, and God would write them immediately in the book of life, and they would live that kind of happy existence. The thing is, no matter who you are, you're bound to slip up at some point. So that's one person who falls into the book of life category. But then also, and this is where it gets very counterintuitive, there's also the Rasha, Shadino Nosing L'Shan Lo Schar Tov Lom Hazeh Al Maisa Tov Sha'asa. You see, Rishayim, the same thing that applies to Tzadikim applies to Rishayim, to wicked people. Even wicked people have done some good in their life, no matter how small it may have been. And therefore, God has to give them their reward at some point. And what God decides is, wait, should I give them their reward in the afterlife, or do I give them their reward in this world? So what we'll talk about later why this is true, but what God says is that the same way the righteous person is put in the book of life because he has no sins, a Rasha, a wicked person who has a little bit of reward, he did something good, we're going to give him his reward in this world, and then he suffers the full consequences of his actions in the world to come. And what's ironic about that is that if we look back at that Gemara, the Gemara that says that the righteous are written in the book of life, that means that the same way a fully righteous and pious person is written in the book of life, so too someone who is mostly sinful will also be put in the book of life so that they get their reward in this world and suffer the consequences in the world to come. So that is the approach to understanding who falls immediately into the book of life. And they're called tzaddikim gemurim. They're called absolutely righteous because they're treated in that way, even though the second person that falls in that category, in fact, is primarily a sinner. Okay, so let's just pause here. Is there anything I can clarify? Any questions on the formulation so far?
Yes, I have a question, Rabbi.
Sure.
Now, the length of someone's life has nothing to do with good or evil.
Okay, excellent question. So you're already actually getting to something that I don't know if we'll reach today, but because you brought it up, I'm going to spoil it for all of us. I'm just kidding. Ramban says also another way that Ramban says not to take the Gemara literally is that the book of life doesn't mean literally life, and the book of death doesn't mean literally death. You can see there's a certain theme over here where he completely just reinterprets the Gemara. What does it mean, book of life? Life doesn't just mean, I live for this year, but life also means the quality of life as well. Life can mean suffering, and it could also have to do with how long someone lives. Now, this is going to be a separate class that we're going to deal with, which I think speaks to your question, which is people, when they're born into this world, there is some sort of philosophical assumption that there is a set amount of time that someone is going to live. Because if that weren't the case, if we had someone who was a tzaddik gamor who never sinned in their life, technically they should never die because they never did anything wrong. So the understanding is that death is part of natural human condition, and everyone has to reach that point down the line at some point. But however, of course, if someone's lifespan is shortened, that could be viewed as some form of punishment. And we're going to look into that as well. He's going to address this later on. Okay?
But good, thank you. That up.
Any other questions or things that we could clarify? Okay. So let's just go a little bit further just to complete this piece. And I think we'll end at about 9:45 is when this shear slot usually ends, right? Oh, Toby.
It goes to 10.
Oh, it goes to 10. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right, fine. So we have an hour together. Wonderful. Okay, so let's go a little further. So there's, now that we talked about who falls into the category of the Book of Life, let's figure out who falls into the category of immediately being put in the Book of Death. So the same way that someone who never sins in their life, who's completely righteous, immediately gets put in the Book of Life, so too, someone who is completely wicked, never gave even a penny to tzedakah their entire life, they get put into the Book of Death. But again, similar to how it's very hard to ever have someone who never sinned in their life, it's very hard to find someone who never committed at least some small act, some good deed in their entire life. But nonetheless, theoretically, that exists. And that's why the category is called Rishayim Gemurim, absolute wicked people. But if you look in this category, there's another person. Before we talked about someone who's mostly wicked, but has a few good deeds. But now we have someone, V'chein Baal Maisa HaTov, Shenichshal Baver Achas Vavad. Let's say someone who committed only one sin their entire life. They were a good person otherwise. They always performed mitzvos. They were always learning Torah. They're always performing tzedakah. Think about all the different mitzvos in the Torah. But they, you know, one time they did an aver. One time they gave in to their taiva. They gave in and they went to McDonald's, right? That's the classic example that every rabbi gives. You go to McDonald's because that's the only sin we could think of. V'nen asher lav lemisa. So therefore, that person gets punished with death in their lifetime. That way, nechta v'nechta ma'alta brosh Hashanah lemisa. Komer shiyamas b'shana hazos. Meaning that they'll die this coming year, they don't necessarily have to die that coming year, because what does that mean? The second someone sins and then they die, that doesn't happen either. So rather, many times, instead of someone dying that particular year, if they have a few sins that they need to atone for, what God does is sheyichya b'tachluyim ra'im chayitzar b'yisurim. They'll live out their lifespan, but they'll live in pain, they'll live in suffering, and they'll live with great difficulty. And that is in order to purify them from any sins that they committed. So that way, when they enter the life eternal, all they'll receive is reward and no punishment. V'nimsa zeh rasha gamor bidino. That means that this person, even though he's fundamentally a good, righteous, mitzvah-performing person, still he falls, ironically, into the category of a Rasha Gamor, an absolute wicked person, in the sense that he gets the same judgment as the wicked person, in that he either has his life cut short, or he lives a life of suffering and difficulty. Ava Pisha Zeh, Toby, yes.
Yeah, I'm just not following a lot of this because I don't see where tshuva comes in, or is that's going to be in the future classes?
Very good. So thank you for bringing that up.
Does tshuva have some role in changing these decrees? I mean,
absolutely. And so
these statements by the Ramban are presuming that tshuva has not been done.
Okay, great. So Toby, I think your intuition is correct that this is presuming tshuva is not done. Look back. So let's just recall a Gemara we saw at the opening of the class. At the opening of the class, in that Gemara at the end, it said, Beinanim, those who are in between, those who aren't completely on one side or the other, they have a chance to perform tshuva. They are tuluyim v'omdim. They are suspended between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which is the 10 days of repentance, the Aseret Yemei Tshuva. And during those 10 days, if somebody is 50-50 on the fence, that is the opportunity to swing the scales in their favor. So, in theory,
how can this one person who's done only one sin in their whole life not fall into that category?
So, okay. So the assumption, can you repeat the question? I just want to understand.
So wouldn't it be that the person who only performed one sin would automatically get that opportunity to do tshuva? It wouldn't be an automatic decree.
So that's going to be a subject of debate we're going to see later on, which is the definition of the middle category. Does the middle category mean 50-50, meaning I'm 50% sin, 50% righteous deeds? Or, like what you're describing, is the middle category anyone who's not absolutely on one extreme or the other, not absolutely only sin or only righteous deeds? So that actually will be a debate that we are going to explore, the definition of Beinonim. And according to those who understand that as long as you're not 100% in either direction, you get put in the middle category, that is exactly the point of those days of repentance between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Thank you, but thank you for bringing that up. That's important detail that, God willing, we'll explore. And if we don't, you'll hold me to it, and I'll make sure that we do. All right? Okay. Just rewind a little bit here. Aval pi shezeh. Skip a lot of footnotes for now. Aval pi shezeh tzadik v'zoche l'chai olam haba. So even though this person is tzaddik and he earns olam haba, even though he's a righteous person and he's earned olam haba, that was the end of that sentence. Barishon shezach lechayim. So a rasha that we talked about before, who has a few mitzvos, even though he gets to live, a rasha gamor, someone who only has sin, va'ove legamri, he is automatically, he's sent straight into hell, straight into Gehenim. We'll talk about exactly what Gehenim is much later down the line, but he gets put straight into punishment. That's the end of that idea. And here is, if this sounds a little theoretical now, but let's bring up two biblical characters that actually fit these paradigms. One character that fits his paradigm, Achia Gadol Shemenevim Kishanidon Achit Echad Kal Benesh Alav Nikra. Nikra Bekan Rasha Gamor. Moshe Rabbeinu, all he did was he committed just one sin his entire life. Maybe he did a little more than that. That's a Parsha class. But let's say all he did, let's say that was the only sin he did, was hit that rock. Let's just say, for argument's sake, he hit the rock, that was a sin, or he berated the Jewish people. That was enough to put Moshe Rabbeinu, one of the most righteous people to ever exist, in the category of a Rasha Gamor, of being considered fully wicked. It doesn't mean to say Moshe Rabbeinu was fully wicked. It means that Moshe is getting judged the same way a fully wicked person is. The same way that fully wicked person gets put to death or suffers in this world, so too Moshe Rabbeinu, he had to die early and was not able to enter into the land of Israel. He's called a Rasha Gamor for the purposes, the legal purposes, so to speak, of deciding which category he falls into. And on the other extreme, if we look into the Sifrei Nevi'im, into the Book of Prophets, but via Achav, also when it comes to King Achav, Ahab, who was one of the most wicked kings that we had in Israel. Kishnerbo haresa ki nichna Achav nilfanai. God says to Eliyahu Hanavi, to Elijah, have you noticed that Achav has submitted himself before me? He's repented. Yan ki nichna mipanai, lo avi harab yamav. And because of his one good act, I will not bring destruction in his days. Here, Nikra Bekan, Sadik Gamor. So what happens is that Achav, the wicked king Achav, he married Jezebel, and they ordered the murder of hundreds of prophets of God. One of the most wicked people we have here in Nach. Yet, he falls into the category of a Tzadik Gamor. He falls into the same category as someone who is completely righteous. In the sense that the same way someone who never committed a sin gets to live the next year and does not suffer, so too, this person who had one or two good deeds under his belt that he committed, he also gets reward in this world in order so that he doesn't get that reward in the world to come. Now, let me just raise a question, which we'll explore a little bit more in depth later. Why is it that someone, and this is a question for all my friends here, what's the reason you think that someone who performed a mitzvah or two in their entire life, they only get rewarded in this world? If they performed a mitzvah, why can't they get a little bit of that reward in the world to come? Why is God only giving them finite reward, a limited reward in this finite life that we live in this world? Why wouldn't God just give a little bit of reward for life eternal? Meaning, if I'm 100%, if I perform 100% mitzvahs in my life, then I get that 100% reward in the world to come. So the person who performs only 1% of their deeds are mitzvahs in their life, why can't they get that 1% as infinite reward? Wouldn't that be fair? What would you say? So let's leave that as a question for now. I'll give you one approach to it, and I think this is the most compelling approach. The approach is that if someone, and this is, I guess, more of a sermon topic than a shiur topic, but it all connects. My Rebbe at YU, Rav Stavelovsky, one of my Rebbeim, he always liked to say, you know, this makes for a good Shabbos morning sermon topic, which was his way of dismissing something and saying, yeah, I don't really find it compelling, but you can make a nice drasha out of it. So here's an idea, and you'll tell me if you think it's compelling. So someone, it's not simply about quantity. It's not simply about how many mitzvos someone performs. It's about why you perform the mitzvos as well. So if I perform a mitzvah because I believe that I'm doing this, I believe that there's a God, I believe that there's reward and punishment, I believe that there's an afterlife, and that is part of my motivation to perform the mitzvah, well, it's fair that if that's why I'm operated, if that's how I operate, that my reward should also be in the afterlife. But if someone doesn't believe in consequence for their action, they don't believe that God rewards and punishes in the world to come, if they live their life like their life only matters right now when they live here on this earth, then it makes sense that they get their reward here on this earth as well. So that's an approach that we're going to see later on. I'm just sprinkling in some tidbits right now. A lot of the questions that Susan, Toby, and others brought up are each fall into almost separate classes on their own. Okay, we have about 10 minutes left, so let's just make a little more progress. If there, this is a good point. If there's anyone who has any other questions, now's a good time to jump in. Okay, good. So I hope that. Oh yes, Toby.
Sparked by your last comment, isn't it superior to be doing a mitzvah? Well, I guess not. You're supposed to do a mitzvah because God told you to do the mitzvah. But, you know, if you do it without any regard to reward, isn't that the best? You know, that you're not thinking about God's going to reward me here, now, tomorrow, whenever. Isn't that the best? So, because you were mentioning that you do the mitzvah thing, you know, with the almost like it's like making a contract. I'm contracting that I'm going to be rewarded in the future, so that's when I should be rewarded. But I thought we're not supposed to be thinking about reward.
Right. So, Toby, what you're saying is correct, and it's explicit admission on Pirkei Avos. It says that we're not supposed to be working for God, almanas lekabel pras. In order, we shouldn't be like avadim, those who serve God, in order to receive reward. So we're going to delve into this in more depth, but because you bring it up, let's just address it briefly now. There are different levels of serving God. So one level, of course, is to, let's break it down like this. There, I could be performing a mitzvah unwittingly, meaning I don't believe that God told me to give charity. I just occurred to me that I should give charity because intuitively it feels like something good to do. So that would be one level. A level right above that would be to do it because God commands me to right do it. And then a level above that is I'm not doing it that middle category is, let me back up. The middle category is I know that God is going to reward me for doing it, and I want reward from God, and I'm willing to submit my will to God's will in order to be rewarded for that action. Mm-hmm. And then another level on top of that is doing it not because there's schar v'onesh. True, that's always in the background, but on top of that, I'm doing it because I simply want to perform the will of God here on earth. That is my goal. I'm a servant of God. And you are correct. So I would say that those two categories, the category of doing it because God wants me to do it, and the category below it, just to receive reward, fall into their own actual category. And then there's a category lower than those two, which is I completely unwittingly perform a mitzvah, not knowing that I performed a mitzvah that God wanted. I can be living in Israel for a shmita year, and I happen to just say, you know what, I'm going to take a sabbatical year and not work my farm. And, you know, lo and behold, I've observed aspects of shmita year by not working the land of Israel in the seventh year, but that doesn't mean I'm performing a mitzvah. I just happen passively to be doing that. So that's a distinction that we're going to delve into more. So the wicked person, if they are serving God, not for the purpose of serving God, they just happen to perform the mitzvah, then it makes sense that their reward would be put in this world. So that's the brief answer. I was planning on dedicating a class specifically to this topic, so hopefully we could answer more thoroughly, and hopefully it'll be more more satisfactory at that point. All right?
Rabbi.
Great. Yes, Lloyd.
I was wondering, who decides what's a mitzvah and what isn't? There are many cases where I think that you think you're doing a mitzvah, but somebody else judges it as an error, I guess. It's not a mitzvah. And therefore, who in the world really gets to decide on earth what's a mitzvah and what isn't?
So what you're pointing out is that many times, and this could come to, I guess, more politically charged discussion, someone will say, I'm being very zealous, I'm performing the will of God here, and then someone says, no, you're doing the opposite of that, so who gets to determine what's a mitzvah and what's not? So, of course, I know the premise of your question, of course, that God ultimately determines what's a mitzvah and what's not, but how we determine that in this world, I think, is the system that Rabbinic Judaism is predicated upon, which is that we have the Torah from God, we have the rabbis throughout our tradition who are the experts in that Torah, who are the bearers of the tradition, and through the Talmud and through the commentaries on the Talmud, the Shulchan Aruch, and the various commentaries on that, that's our best shot at determining what's a mitzvah and what's not a mitzvah. So a mitzvah isn't determined by, I read the latest article in the Forward and someone says that it's a mitzvah to support X initiative or X political party. That's not who determines what a mitzvah is. A mitzvah is determined by someone who has expertise. So usually I personally would go to a posek to ask that question. I would go to someone who has superior expertise. Someone like Rabbi Herschel Schachter, someone like Rabbi Mordechai Willig, or Rabbi Moshe Tendler. Those are ultimately the authorities that I would trust to best have their finger on the pulse and expertise in the sources to figure out what is a mitzvah and what is a sin. Does that answer your question?
Somewhat, yes. But in my mind, is I wonder if Party A says that's a good, you did a great deed, but Party B says no, because you did a good deed for a wicked person. And therefore, we contributed to his wickedness. So forth.
You have an example to share?
Even though the authorities might say, hey, my case, I'm not aware of them. But I think it's a very difficult dichotomy that we have to live with, because how do we know if it's a mitzvah or not?
Right. Do you are you thinking of a particular example by any chance?
I prefer not to mention it.
Oh, okay. Definitely don't share anything you're not comfortable with. but my general approach to answering that question again is that I try to do what the Torah says, which is our source book for the mitzvos, and I trust the experts to interpret what are mitzvos, what aren't, and I generally don't trust an op-ed Jewish Week or The Forward or any other magazine or newspaper to tell me what's a mitzvah and what's not. I could pen an op-ed, it doesn't matter, but I trust the rabbinic authorities who know a lot more than I do to help me figure that out. Okay, It looks like we are at the end of our time for today. Are there any other questions that I can address? Okay. So thank you all for joining. And again, all the class I'm teaching now, a lot of this is experimental. You know, I want to see what works for people, what people enjoy, what you guys think that maybe I can do better at. So please feel free. You can email me, rabbikurtz@csstanford.org, and you can call me. Feel free to share any thoughts. I'm open to it and looking forward to learning together in the future. All right. All right. Have a great Shabbos, everyone. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Bye-bye.